Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Wednesday, July the 4th. A special welcome to our listeners in America. This is Newsdesk from the Old Country. I'm Matt Wells. Good news from Gaza at last, with the release of the BBC correspondent Alan Johnson. We'll hear from him and from the head of BBC News. Gordon Brown has set out plans to reform the UK constitution. What exactly does that mean for citizens of Britain? We report from Belfast, where there may be an end to the armed conflict, but there's no less division with the construction of a new peace wall. And 25 years after the first man died from AIDS in Britain, we'll hear about his legacy from his partner. Plus, the usual sift through the day's papers, and a detour via John Henley's diary makes up today's news desk. The 114-day nightmare is over for Alan Johnson and his family. The BBC Gaza correspondent was released in the early hours of the morning amid chaotic scenes after Hamas apparently brokered a deal. Johnson looked tired and thin, but he was well enough to speak at a press conference with the disputed Hamas Prime Minister in Gaza, Ismail Haniyeh.
The last 16 weeks, of course, just the very worst you can imagine of my life. It was like being buried alive, really, removed from the world, and occasionally terrifying. You were in the hands of people who were dangerous and unpredictable and always frightening, in that you didn't know when it might end. And after 2 months, 3 months, you think, why might I not be here in 9 months, 18 months or longer? And just the most unimaginable relief that it's finally over. I dreamt many times, literally dreamt of being free again.
The news came to the BBC in the middle of the night. I talked to the corporation's director of news, Helen Bowden.
Well, I found out sometime, I can't actually remember what the time was, it was probably sort of quarter to two, two-ish, when the phone went. And I just thought, oh my God, this is either the good news or the bad news. Lifted the phone and it was my wonderful foreign editor, John Williams, to say, Helen, Alan is free. It was a very, very powerful moment.
Do you know anything about the circumstances of how he was released?
We actually know very little. I mean, for some days there have been negotiations between Hamas and the Dogmush clan. I mean, that's been going on for some time. But we've sort of had so many ebbs and flows on it that actually we were all taken aback by this. We felt there was a momentum growing, but there's been a momentum at other times that's come to nothing. And always this negotiation has really been about internal Palestinian politics. It's never really been about the BBC.
I was going to say,
so whatever was done, you know, they did it between themselves.
I was going to say, do we know if any ransom was paid?
Well, they say not. We don't know.
With hindsight now, and we haven't asked this question before, but now that he's free, perhaps we can. Do you feel that the BBC had done enough to ensure Alan Johnson's safety? Should he have been brought out earlier?
No, I don't think he should have done. I mean, to some extent, we relied on Alan as the expert in Gaza. He was fairly confident about all the arrangements that we had. We've always known kidnap is a possibility in Gaza, although no one's ever been held for as long as Alan was held. We take terrific precautions. I mean, the fact is that we knew very quickly that Alan had been taken, because we always have a ring-back mechanism whereby when you're going somewhere, you will say, I'll ring you within an hour. And it was when he hadn't done that, we knew the situation had gone bad for us. The reality is you have to take a calculated risk when you put people in dangerous places, and dangerous places tend to be newsworthy places. And I think we calculated that risk fairly effectively, but it is a risk. And, you know, the risk was that it was a possibility, and very sadly for Alan, that possibility came true.
There was a great campaign for him to be released. Did that make any difference, do you think?
I think, first of all, it kept him in the public eye, and particularly the public eye in the Middle East, which really mattered. It kept him in the public eye here, which was fantastically supportive for his family and his colleagues and his friends. But actually, most importantly, we now discover that Alan, first of all, saw the original news conference on television, where his parents and I were there talking about him and the need for him to be released. And he was then given a radio. He no longer had television, I think, but was then given a radio and heard everything we were doing on the World Service, which was, as he has said, immensely heartening and encouraging.
Hamas, which seized control of Gaza last month and which has since been trying to build its credibility abroad, was keen to take credit for Johnson's release. Here's our correspondent in Gaza City, Conal Urquhart.
First of all, they stated quite clearly about 2 weeks ago, just after they took control of Gaza, that they were determined that he be released. Initially, they said he'd be released in about 24 hours, and that didn't materialise. So after that failed, they sent various delegations to the Dormouche family to persuade them that what they were doing was un-Islamic and un-Palestinian. And when that failed as well, they increased the sort of military pressure. They put roadblocks around the area where the family lived, where they believed Alan was being held, and they moved these roadblocks closer and closer. And yesterday, that pressure increased. They took over the rooftops of apartment buildings so they could, you know, fire down. They had a clear view of the area where the family was based. And they made noises that suggested they may actually go and try a rescue attempt. And this led to further negotiations. It's not quite clear how they were managed, whether there were some, you know, clerics involved or other militants. But they actually finally talked and came to some kind of compromise.
Do we know what nature of any deal that might have been done?
I think initially when he was taken, there may have been some money involved. There may have been after money. But after Hamas took control, I think their desires changed very quickly. And it seemed they were after guarantees for their future security and safety.
Obviously, the release of Alan Johnson is being used politically by Hamas to try and show that they've brought order to Gaza. What does Hamas get out of this, do you think?
From the beginning, the British Consul General came to meet Hania. And this was the first meeting with a senior Hamas official and a Western diplomat since they came to power. So that was already quite a coup for them. And I think that made them very determined to get a successful result. But more importantly, they've established their credibility and their ability to impose a certain degree of security in the Gaza Strip. This is something which Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and the Palestinian Authority and Fatah have absolutely failed to do. So that's the major thing. There's a contrast between what's come before and what is coming now. So they're going to make the most of this to try and get sort of international recognition.
That's Guardian's Con Lurkert in Gaza City. Now, that story came too late for most of the papers, but not Matt Weaver for The Guardian.
Yeah, just to blow our own trumpet, The Guardian published a sixth edition last night in the early hours to cover the release.
Lord.
It says that Johnson looked pale and frail, but told reporters he was okay. It reports that his release came after Hamas security forces surrounded buildings in Gaza City where he was held, and quotes the leader of Hamas, Khaled Massal, claiming that Johnson's release signals that Hamas has brought order to the Gaza Strip. An early edition of The Times, which came out before the release was confirmed, reminds us of how fortunate Johnson was. It says that there was mounting concern about his safety when shooting broke out in and around the compound where he was being held.
OK, so I'm sure there'll be more. The rest of the papers will catch up tomorrow with more of that good news. Elsewhere in the papers today, though, Matt, there's more details of the investigations into the terror plots.
Yeah, The Telegraph says that MI5 are on to some of the doctors suspected of plotting the attacks. It says one was on a Home Office watch and others were on a file of 2,000 suspected jihadists. The fact that they were on the radar was one reason why the investigation has moved so fast, it says. The Times, meanwhile, has news that an Anglican cleric in Baghdad had been cryptically warned of the attacks by doctors in Britain. It says Canon Andrew White had been told by an Al-Qaeda leader that those who cure you will kill you. It says he passed on the warning to the Foreign Office in April. Meanwhile, The Mirror reports that gas canisters used to make the car bombs were bought from a B&Q store in Paisley for $29.95 each. The B&Q bombers, it calls them.
How extraordinary. Now, I see that the FT has the first interview with the new Chancellor, Alistair Darling.
Yep, and in it he says that he won't abolish tax perks for private equity firms, as many have been clamouring for in the last few days. I think we should be very wary indeed of knee-jerk reaction, he tells the paper, and he says he fears unintended consequences of such a move. But apart from that, the FT didn't get much else out of him. Mr. Darling appeared characteristically determined to say nothing to frighten the horses, it says.
Or indeed to frighten the horses from the FT. Now, listen, I see that there's more pictures and more stories about President Sarkozy of France. He fancies his chances as a bit of a marathon runner, doesn't he?
Yeah, Mr. Nicolas Sarkozy's passion for jogging is annoying French intellectuals, according to The Times.
Is it not highbrow enough?
No. It says the sight of Sarkozy jogging has become a ritual of power, like Louis XIV riding his horse at Versailles.
Oh, I see. How interesting.
France's chattering classes think that jogging is right-wing and un-French.
I wonder what a left-wing activity would be, presumably sort of sitting in your home and reading up on French intellectuals, I should imagine. Now, finally, we've heard about the rain at Wimbledon. It always rains in Wimbledon fortnight, but there's been some quite extraordinary weather in London.
Yeah, just when you thought that the weather couldn't get any worse, says the Daily Mail, Britain was bombarded with hailstones.
Well, I think London was bombarded by
yes,
hailstones.
For Britain, read a little bit of South London. For a brief moment, Clapham and Battersea were shrouded in white, and pictures of it are all over the papers.
Hold the front page, yes.
It rather bears out Polly Toynbee's theory that the media is obsessed with the weather only when it happens in London and ignores or downplays the deluge in Yorkshire.
Yes, I think it's the sort of further away from London it is, the lower down the running order it comes.
Yeah, but a very small story in the Telegraph reminds us that flood evacuees in Yorkshire may have to wait for months to get their homes back.
Oh dear. Well, sorry about that if you're listening in Yorkshire and you're still out of your homes. Hope you get back soon. Matt Weaver, thanks very much. Do remember to sign up to our daily paper review at guardian.co.uk/wrap. Now, Gordon Brown has set out an ambitious programme of constitutional reform. I guess it's the rather dull but important initiative that we should come to expect from our new Prime Minister. I asked our political correspondent, Tanya Branigan, to spell it out for us.
It's going to be a very, very sweeping package of reforms, yes. Now, technically, we sort of have a written constitution, but nobody really understands it because it's piecemeal. It's not a document. It's a sort of a whole sort of set of different laws and documents and so forth. What Brown is doing is really sort of pushing through quite sweeping changes, and the idea is partly to hand more powers back to Parliament, but it's also really to set out much more clearly, in particular, the rights and responsibilities of the citizen, which is something that he's been very keen to do, and one way for that would be a new Bill of Rights, which is what he's proposing in this green paper.
And what other measures is Gordon Brown outlining?
There's a huge range of things in here. Some of it is really touching on subjects that have been very controversial in the last few years. For example, the role of the Attorney General, which people sort of say has conflicts of interest. He's talking about potentially reducing the age of voting to 16, about perhaps holding elections on Sundays to try and encourage turnout. He's talking about handing all sorts of powers back to MPs. And most of these are to do with the royal prerogative, which is sort of best known really because it allows the Prime Minister to declare war. And he's saying that from now on, MPs should be able to make that decision.
Interesting that this was all the details of this first came out in Parliament and not the media.
Yes, absolutely. He's very, very keen to try and draw a line, really, under the Blair years to say that he's about substance, that he's not about spin, that he's going to take things to MPs before he publishes them through the media. A bit boring and frustrating for us at times, of course, but it does mean that when you get the sort of wide-ranging package that we saw yesterday, it's genuinely surprising and startling. Most of this hadn't leaked out. People had made some quite good guesses as to what would be in there. We certainly knew that he sort of wanted to hand the power to go to war over to the Commons. But most of the things in there were really startling, and people were surprised by how far he'd gone.
No chance, I see, though, that the English Votes for English Issues campaign that the Tories have been running is going to succeed?
No, he was very keen to make it clear that that was off the agenda. Now, I mean, there is a serious issue here. It's one that's been it's an issue that's been sort of running for a long time, and it's obviously sort of come to the forefront more and more. But it's also something that the Tories have been very sort of keen to pursue for their own political purposes, just to remind people that Gordon Brown is Scottish.
Tanya Branigan there, sounding particularly English. Now, despite the peace process breakthrough in Northern Ireland, dozens of so-called peace walls still separate some Catholic and Protestant estates in Belfast and Derry. And there's no sign of them coming down any time soon. In fact, as Mark Oliver reports, there are plans to build a new one.
Northern Ireland's so-called peace lines are walls of various forms and sizes that separate what they call interface areas, places where Catholic and Protestant estates intersect. The idea is that they stop missile attacks on homes and make residents feel safer. The walls started to be built as the Troubles flared in the late 60s, and today remain physical reminders that despite the progress of the peace process, there is still a way to go. Guardian Ireland correspondent Owen Bocott and I are at Hazelwood Primary School, an integrated Catholic and Protestant primary in North Belfast, where plans to build a new 25-foot peace line down one side of the school have divided residents and parents.
There's an awful lot of the parents don't really think it's necessary because there hasn't been too much trouble. Plus, kids are only going to start asking questions, and when they're that young, you don't really want to have to go into the ins and outs of what it's all for and all. Well, I don't.
That was Kelly Mannon, a mother of two who was picking up her children at the school, which sits between the Loyalist White City Estate and the Catholic Old Throne Estate. Owen Bocott.
The situation was bad there last summer when there were petrol bomb attacks on some Catholic homes in the Old Throne Estate, where Loyalist youths came through the school grounds and threw a few bricks and slate tiles from the school and petrol bombs. In one case, they set light to a house. There's some people in the Nationalist Estate feel they need the wall for security. They're worried about more attacks and they want to be sure that they're sleeping safely at night. Others recognise that there's going to be problems there, but they're fairly low level, that this year it hasn't been as bad as before. And they fear that a 25-foot peace wall will obstruct their view of Cave Hill, which is a beautiful outcrop of rock on the mountain above Belfast.
The plan is to build the wall between the school and the Catholic estate. Two parents, David Johnston and Lorna Bradley, have mixed views about the wall.
Hopefully through time we'll be able to bring all the peace walls down. But if it's going to solve the problem in the meantime, yeah, I don't see a problem with it.
It's just typical kids messing about, and I don't think there's any real bad trouble. Just kids messing.
You've seen here, we've had the wee sports day here today, and the parents are going up there and watching the kids together, walking home together. And
playing together and even shopping together, all shop together. So, I mean, I think personally that it's actually teenagers really having a drink and going mad.
Residents of the nearby Loyalist White City estate say that the wall doesn't really affect them. They say they've had problems in the past with houses being stoned, but that was more last year, and since then the problems haven't been anywhere near as bad as they used to be. One pensioner told us how 6 years ago she had petrol poured through her letterbox.
It was at 20 to 4 in the morning. My two grandchildren were staying with me that particular night. We had to climb back out under a wee back roof because the whole bottom of the stairs was on fire and I had to sit there and wait.
But the lady added that things had improved so much recently that in the past couple of weeks she'd taken the grills off her windows that had previously been there to protect them.
Oh, they're only down now this 2 weeks.
Oh, right.
I've had the house painted because it's been so quiet.
And you're going to put them up again?
Well,
hopefully not.
But... All right, well, that's a good idea.
Away from the school in the Republican heartland of the Falls Road in West Belfast is the Falls Community Centre, which is overlooked by a mural of Pat Finucane, the murdered Catholic solicitor. Inside the centre, we spoke to its director, Jerry McConville, who said the general problem these days was so-called recreational violence by youths not linked to paramilitaries.
I remember talking to a young lad, he was about 14, and I said, why do you do it? And he says, well, that's what you do on an interface. He throws stones across it. But the whole thing is that very often it is about young people gathering at corners, taunting each other, name-calling, and a few stones get thrown. And it's important that we have the capacity locally to deal with that. You know, that there are people in each area who are prepared to come out and deal with that within their communities. I would say that we should try everything before, you know, building any more peace lanes, because there's no such thing as temporary peace lanes. Peace lanes invariably become permanent.
25 years ago this week, a man called Terry Higgins died, sealed off in an isolation unit at St Thomas's Hospital in London. Doctors had little idea about how to treat him. He had what's now known as AIDS. Times have changed considerably since then. The Terence Higgins Trust, a charity set up by his friends, has ensured that his name lives on. New drugs mean far fewer people die from AIDS, at least in developed countries. But the number of HIV infections is still astonishingly high. One HIV survivor is Terry Higgins' partner, Rupert Whittaker. I went to meet him at his home in southwest London, and he told me about how they'd met.
We met in a club. He was dancing and I liked the way he danced, and it was a slightly unusual way of dancing. We got talking and it went from there. I was away for the first year of university at that time, and Terry was, you know, he was my first lover, and it was quite magical, and I really didn't want to be away from him, obviously. He started complaining of real problems. Dreadful headaches and this, that and the other, and he had already lost a lot of weight before I'd met him. The physicians who came to treat him at the time had no idea what was going on. There was quite a sense of alarm about it, and he was kept in isolation. And he got very sick very fast, which was the way in those days. The problems, you know, in dealing with his being in isolation were, well, I wasn't allowed in to see him. I was allowed to look through a window in a door at first into a sealed room. It was very hard to deal with because I didn't really know what on earth was going on. And at the same time, I was starting to feel sick myself. When he died, I was told that I would have to read what he died from in a medical journal because they wouldn't tell me directly. It's only been in the last few years that I've actually assumed that I'm going to be around for more than 5 and probably 10 and hopefully more than that. There have been several real hiccups along the way, twice when I've been sufficiently close to death that it was not funny anymore.
And that brings us on to the interesting issue about HIV today. And 1 in 9 gay men in London has the virus. Not all of them know it, but the attitude of very many young gay men is that it's not really something that they need to worry about, particularly because there are treatments, and, you know, even if, perish the thought, that you are infected, it's treatable.
Well, if people do think that, and I know they do, I feel very, very sorry for them, because they're setting themselves up for a very nasty shock. The treatments, yes, there are treatments, and they are getting better. However, they can be dreadful to live with. I had diarrhoea for 8 years, and not just sort of mild diarrhoea, this was catastrophic diarrhoea.
What's your message for people who are making policy about HIV and AIDS now?
The primary issue in dealing with AIDS today is that it's got to be recognised that it's not simply a biological disease. It's a behaviourally driven epidemic, and there has to be some serious ways to address the behavioural aspects of the disease. You get it because of behaviour. It gets worse often because of behaviour. It is transmitted because of behaviour. And the answers are not in whichever of the latest fashionable pills comes from some pharmaceutical giant. The failure to integrate behavioural and biological approaches to the disease has meant that the disease has become much worse than it needs to in Britain.
Rupert Whittaker there, and there's more on the 25th anniversary of the Terence Higgins Trust at societyguardian.co.uk. Time for the diary now. John Henley joins us now via the wonders of voice over internet protocol technology from Diary World headquarters. John, over to you.
Right, our coveted Let's Restore the Faith of the British People in the Noble Calling That Is Politics award goes today to the boy Cameron, whose entry yesterday on the ever-entertaining David's Diary section of his web, Cameron, quite rightly points out, and we quote, that Brown's been PM for a week and it hasn't stopped raining. Dave's also, it seems, good enough mates with the Broom to call him Gord, which we're sure will help when it comes to obtaining cross-party agreement on all those tricky constitutional changes. So hats off to him. We'll be deriving no amusement whatsoever from the fact that there is a chest specialist at the University Hospital of North Staffordshire called Dr. Pantin, that the assistant manager at the Taro Leisure Centre in Petersfield is called Sarah Darts, and that the chairman of Bedford Borough Council's Standards Committee is a Mr. C. Ensor, because, Matt, as you know, this is not a column that makes fun of people's names. Moving on, Vanity, thy name is Facebook. Last Friday, we hear Jim Knight, St. Tony's Minister for Schools, was waiting by his phone for a call. Would he be Minister under the Broom? Well, the call came at 13:50, we hear from a very, very reliable source, and our hero, hurrah, was asked indeed to be Minister for Schools at exactly 13:51. And how do we know the time? Well, he posted the details on his Facebook profile as it happened. We're not sure whether to applaud him for being quite so down with the kids or commiserate with him for being so irremediably and pathetically sad. And finally, Matt, finally, we'll be wondering at a perfectly splendid profile of our new Prime Minister in the Spanish newspaper El Mundo, which boldly states that Brown's love life, and we quote, was very active before he met his new wife, Sarah. Something we don't know, perhaps?
What an extraordinary thought. Thank you very much, John. There's more on the aftermath of Alan Johnson's release on MediaGuardian.co.uk. Don't miss, by the way, our media podcast, Media Talk, available from Friday. The producer of Newsdesk was Phil Maynard. I'm Matt Wells. Goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.